evening and welcome to the first of the WOL Power Talk series. I'm Carl Nelson, I'm your host, and tonight we'll be discussing the Derek Chauvin trial. Joining us will be a civil rights and constitutional attorney, you've heard him before on the radio, attorney A. Dwight Pettit, and also political analyst and political analyst himself, Dr. Wilmer Leon. So let's bring them on. Let's first, attorney Pettit, welcome to the Power Talk series.
What's that, Carl?
Welcome. I'm just welcoming you to the
thank
party.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. And let's bring on Dr. Leon. Dr. Leon.
Good evening, Carl. Good evening, Attorney Pettit. Gentlemen,
good evening,
a pleasure.
Dr. Leon.
All right. This trial has riveted the country. You know, since the OJ trial, we haven't seen a trial like this that everybody's so focused on. And let's go to Attorney Pettit. I know Dr. Leon, you'll have questions for him as well, and we'll have questions for you. But Attorney Leon, if you had to grade the prosecution's performance so far, what grade would you give them?
I'd say that the prosecution, Carl, is doing everything right in a difficult situation, because folks don't realize how difficult these prosecutions are, because the laws are so tight in terms of protecting the police. And so they're doing a very, very good job in terms of the strategy of making Floyd human, dehumanizing him. They're doing a good job in terms of putting forth the expert testimony. What makes this trial so tremendously significant? Is this the first time that you're seeing the state moving against the police and breaking the blue wall of silence? Here in Baltimore, when we had the Freddie Gray case, the prosecution was trying to prosecute, but the experts were not cooperative. And I see that all of the time. And so this trial has all the experts working in conjunction with the state, and that's making all the difference in the world. If they can't get a conviction on this type of trial, then we're in real trouble.
Wow. Dr. Leon, do you think they were that good?
Yeah, I think the prosecution has done a fantastic job in presenting their case. They're very clear. They're very focused on what their case is based upon, which is excessive use of force and the over 9 minutes that former Officer Chauvin kept his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck, cutting off oxygen to his brain and resulting in a massive coronary. I think they've called their witnesses in a very logical order. They've been very credible, and the manner in which they've laid out their positions has been quite orderly, very clear explanations on very complex medical terminology. I think as the defense would cross-examine the prosecution witnesses and present a lot of hypothetical mumbo jumbo, the prosecution, they'd come right back on redirect and refocus the jury on the issue at hand, not allowing the jury to be distracted by the hypothetical, you know, well, if Mr. Floyd had been a Martian and if there were 42 days in a month instead of 30, ipso facto presto, blah, blah, blah. They haven't allowed any of that to really distract the jury from the case at hand. They open each day strong. They've closed each day strong. To Attorney Pettit's point, I think the fact that the thin blue line has been breached by the senior most officer on the force, by the police chief, and by other members of the police force, and as well as other independent witnesses, I think that's incredibly significant. Yeah. One more point, though, and thank God for video. An irrefutable video. I do take slight issue with Attorney Pettit's point that if the prosecution can't win this one, and I say that because the prosecution has to pitch a shutout. They got to pitch a perfect game, 12-0. Yeah. Whereas the defense, it's 1-11. And here we are in America dealing with a white police officer. All the defense has to play to is that one juror who believes that the police are there to protect them against us. And the prosecution has a problem.
Yeah. How about those odds, Counselor?
Well, I do think it's still difficult because, as I said before, the laws have been so construed and so rendered to, in fact, protect the police. People are not really aware of how the laws slant for the police. I've had cases over and over. I've won most of them, but some of the cases that I have lost where I thought it was a slam dunk. But once the defense got rolling, there's so many different things, such as qualified immunity, such as the continual assessment of brutality, of danger to the officer's safety. And the case that they keep talking about, the case that talks about the objective reasonable officer, the jury is going to be instructed by this judge that you cannot put yourself someplace else. You cannot tell us what you should have done. You cannot tell us what you might do as a quarterback, Monday morning quarterback. You have to put yourself in place of the officer and make the observations in terms of the use of deadly force. Is that officer would seem or render in terms of his objective assessment of the fear that he was in. And all of these standards that have been created by the courts are very, very difficult standards to meet. And we do not know at this point in time how this judge is going to rule in terms of instructions going to the jury and all of these elements of law which are raised beyond what you're seeing in terms of the video. And they are going to be saying, don't believe your lying eyes. That's what the defense is going to try to do in terms of all of this technical and expert testimony and the arguments as a matter of law.
Now, the fact that the judge did not allow Chauvin's, you know, medical check and his background, what he did, but it did allow for George Floyd. Is that a problem for the prosecution?
No, because the question is going to be whether Chauvin takes the stand. If he takes the stand as a witness, then all of his background is going to be relevant. So that's the decision that the defense will have to make, is whether he wants to take tell his story to the jury because they want to hear it versus what he's going to suffer and give away in terms of cross-examination, in terms of his past conduct and the complaints that have been lodged against him. So that's the decision that the defense will have to make as they move into their case once they test all of these other areas that I'm talking about.
Dr. Leon, do you see him taking the stand?
Wow. That's a heck of a question, Carl, because to Attorney Pettit's point, if he takes the stand, he opens himself up to a whole lot of things that they would really prefer not be discussed. But the other side of that is if he doesn't take the stand in a case of this magnitude, one's got to sit back and wonder, excuse me, sir, you didn't come up and defend yourself, but he's not obligated to. So, man, I think right now, because the defense just started their case today, I think it's too early to make that call. I need to see a few more days of what the defense has to present in order to before I can make a sensible determination as to whether or not I think that Chauvin should take the stand. But you know, the other issue too is going to have to do with, because the video is very clear. The video is hard to argue. What the prosecution has to make the point of is intent. As we get into second and third degree murder, the intent, what was Chauvin's intent? And they're going to have to move into the realm of depraved indifference and show how Chauvin totally ignored the fact that he was draining the life out of Mr. Floyd over that 9 minute and 20 some odd second span of time that he had his knee on his neck. And I think there are indicators in terms of body language, in terms of his facial expressions, in terms of how he readjusted his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck to even dig in deeper Those are things that I think will go to depraved indifference. But that's also what I think the prosecution is going to have to show.
Folks, you just joined us. This is a Power Talk series from WOL Radio discussing the Derek Chauvin trial. And already we've got some questions for Dwight Pettit, attorney. And also we have our analyst, Dr. Wilmer Leon. One of the first questions is, will the prosecution lose this case? And the medical analysis that Floyd died as a result of his drug use.
Well, that's the issue of causation. And that's one of the areas that the defense is going to attack, because you have to prove that the cause of death was substantially the knee on the neck. And the defense, as you see now, are introducing all the type of testimony in terms of matters which might have been in Floyd's system. And so they're going to be arguing that, because you got to remember, just as Dr. Leon indicated, the state has a tremendous burden. They got a burden beyond a reasonable doubt. They have to make the case beyond a reasonable doubt and get 12 juries to agree on a conviction. And so this is one of the things that the defense is going to use to confuse the jury that, hey, it might have happened, but this was not the cause of death. The cause of death was other things, heart attack, exhaustion, prior existing things within his bloodstream, and not the asphyxiation, which the state's doctors have talked about in terms of asphyxiation, cutting off blood and oxygen to the brain and to the heart.
And follow up, Doc, because I was going to ask you, Dr. Leon, do you think it was too, I'll let you respond to the question too, but do you think it was too technical? Because a lot of, some of the jurors are sort of nodding off. You think they grasp all of that?
I think that, well, I don't know that the jury grasped all of it, but I think Attorney Pettit would agree that the prosecution did a very, very good job with their witnesses of explaining technical medical terminology in very easy ways for people to understand. I think they did about as good a job as they could do in talking about asphyxiation and when the brain loses oxygen and all that kind of stuff. I think they did a very, very good job. To Attorney Pettit's point, I thought the prosecution did a very good job of diffusing the argument before it was made about the drug abuse question and the methamphetamine and the fentanyl. I thought that their experts were very, very good at saying that had nothing to do with this. In fact, the female, I don't remember her name, she was a forensic pathologist, I believe. She said that the amount of methamphetamine in the system was so negligible. I mean, she was very, very clear that this was not a drug case, that this is a knee on the neck cutting off oxygen to the brain case. But this is where, as I was saying earlier, that I think the prosecution has a problem. If there's a juror on that jury looking to give Chauvin an out, this is one of the places where they will find that out. He was a big black man. He was on drugs. He was a threat. Oh, we have to be protected from these crazy people. And thank God for Chauvin there to protect us from people like this. That's what he's playing to. That's what the defense is playing to, in my opinion. And we've lost a lot. We've lost a lot of cases that were harder than this one.
Yeah. How do you see that?
That were easier than this, I should say.
How do you see it, Attorney Pettit? Do you agree with Dr. Leon?
Yes, I do. I mean, the prosecution has done an heck of a job considering what they're going to face. Not only the causation issue, but as I said before, you have legal issues which are going to be very, very prominent in this trial. Let's go, for example, in terms of training and policy and procedure. Now, what they're going to argue, this is where we get into the potential area of qualified immunity. They're going to argue that, well, he was trained to put the knee on the back. And then they're going to turn around and reverse that and say, well, he was trained to put the knee on the back. And if he put it on his neck, that's because he didn't know all the rules and regulations and prohibitions in his training. And so all of that's going to be expert testimony of how good the experts are. And as indicated by Dr. Leon, if a jury wants an out, all they're going to have to do is say, well, I've got a reasonable doubt. And if they got a reasonable doubt, that's an acquittal or not guilty. And so as these technical issues and of law are argued, causation the area of in terms of danger and preeminent danger and what they call the continuum of force, what we're talking about, the objective reasonable officer feeling that he's in fact in danger. Now, that's why they're trying to use the crowd as part of that reasonable officer issue, because they're trying to say, well, it wasn't just Floyd that he was in danger of. It was also the crowd that was coming up against him. So as a reasonable officer, he did what he had to do because he felt that he was in danger. Now, that argument might sound silly since we have seen the video, but that's a real argument that has been made in these type of cases because the law has been bent to allow that type of argument to be successful. So we have to be very, very careful whether or not this is a slam dunk situation.
All right, got another question for you, gentlemen. Listener watching us actually says, will the results of this trial determine the fate of the other officers? Attorney Pettit, that's for you, I guess.
No, I think that's a different thing as to whether or not, not that they assisted, but whether or not the statutes or laws in that jurisdiction that compelled them to take some action if they saw a wrong being committed. Now, I'm not totally up to the law in that particular state, but that's usually, it's not an aiding or abetting law, but it's a law that says if you watch wrongdoing or criminal act being committed, are you required by law to do something to intervene on that? Now, some of the officers had contact with Floyd, holding his legs, holding up different parts of his body and so forth. So in that area, they can very easily be included in terms of aiding and abetting. But the other area is if the law in that area says they had a responsibility to intervene if they saw criminal conduct, then that could be held liable or criminally liable.
Dr. Leon, I got to ask you this question.
Can I respond to that?
Sure, go ahead.
Because Attorney Pettit, if you could speak to 2 points relative to that question. One is that the civil suit has already been settled. $27 million, I think, the family has received from the state. As I understand it, usually in situations like this, the civil suit is settled after the criminal suit. And in this instance, the state basically already threw in their cards and settled with the family. So does the fact that the jury knows that the state has already settled going into the criminal trial, do you think that's going to have any impact in their thoughts and in their deliberation? And the other issue is similar to what happened in the Rodney King trial with Chauvin was the senior officer on scene. And the training officer for, I think, at least 2, if not more than 2 of the other officers there. So basically, they gave deference. I think the argument would be that they gave deference to Chauvin as the training officer, the way in the Rodney King trial, a number of the officers gave deference to Officer Coons because he was the senior and he was the training officer on the scene.
Well, back to your first question, I think it was a negative situation that the settlement was reached before the trial, the criminal trial. I think Attorney Crump is a very excellent attorney, but that could have happened as a result of insistence by the city to in fact afford some defense for the prosecution of the officers. As to your second question in terms of whether or not...
Chauvin as the senior officer.
Yeah, I think that's all the testimony that was being put forward as to procedure and practices, and that's going to go back to the police procedures and handbooks as to what they should do in certain situations. And that's going to be determined by the internal understanding. And you already have police officers who testified that that is not in the training to put the knee on somebody's neck. It will cause asphyxiation. And so you have that expert testimony. And so that's where we go back to, again, what I was talking about in terms of the element of immunity, as to if him being the major officer in terms of the senior officer, in terms of the training, did he know that he could not extend that force to the area of the element of termination, but could he extend that force to lethal force in terms of his training by moving up from the back area, which they've already testified that he could do according to his training, to a position of on the neck, which is a death hole or death position. And that's again why the experts are going to go back and forth in terms of what he knew, what he should have known, and what he was doing in terms of department regulations, procedures, and practices. And I've seen that again in the Gray case here in Maryland. The judges basically threw the case out, Judge Williams here, because of that policy and procedure argument. So, you know, that's a very dangerous area for the defense to be able to raise for the prosecution.
Okay. Dr. Leon and Attorney Petty, this question is for both of you. The fact that the judge refused to sequester the jury, who does that benefit? Start with you, Dr. Leon. Who do you think that benefits?
I think it gives the defense an option on appeal. Not that that would be a winning argument, but I think that that will be something that they've put in the margins of their yellow legal pads, point of contention for appeal, that what's going on right now in Minnesota, what's playing out on the televisions, as a result of the most recent shooting, I think that will be a point for them to make. That's the best answer I have for you.
Counsel?
Well, I think the judge was correct in not allowing the motion for sequestration, because all of that is taken into account when you, in fact, seat a jury. The questions are, can you be biased, unbiased? Can you, in fact, make a decision on the facts that you hear in the courtroom? And the judge, I'm sure, voir dired them on that type of situation. And so the sequestration of the jury, I think, is a good call non-sequestration of the jury is a good call, which benefits the prosecution, to answer your question directly, Carl.
All right. But does Dr. Leon have a point, though, on appeal? Could that be used on appeal?
Oh, yeah. In a criminal case like this, you make a motion for mistrial at any opportunity that you get to preserve the record for appeal. Oh, yes.
So when would that occur? Would that occur after they finish their presentation?
Well, they have to make the motion for the mistrial, the defense does, at every area of the trial. So they make it once the judge has ruled. They make a motion for mistrial. When the trial comes to the defense, they make a motion for mistrial. And at the end of the trial, they make a motion for mistrial.
So they still can make that motion.
Oh, yeah. That's preserved throughout the trial.
Right. And
that's an appeal.
Let's talk about what's going on in Minnesota, Minneapolis now in the area. How is that going to affect, how do you think, fellas, this is going to affect the outcome of this trial? Do you think some of the jurors are thinking, if I vote this way or vote that way, am I voting to have this mayhem continue in the streets, or should I just want for peace?
I believe, I agree with Attorney Pettit that during voir dire that they were questioned on their ability to be impartial and their ability to render a verdict based upon what they know or what based upon the facts that were presented in the case. Because you could really take this out. If you have an African-American juror, particularly, we have such history for us is so replete with these circumstances. One could make the argument that it's almost impossible for us to be impartial because this happens to us damn near every day. Not that that's a valid argument, but I'm saying that that argument could be made. So, so I think that sequestration, the point to Attorney Pettit, that not sequestering the jury was the right move to make, that you have to trust now that you have 12 impartial individuals that will be able to render a verdict based upon the information presented to them, and that they're not going to use these outside factors, weigh these outside factors in their decisions.
Senator Pettit?
I think that the Wright case, young man that was killed in the same area, approximately 9-10 miles away, is going to have a tremendous impact on the jury, that this has to stop someplace. And, you know, I do think the lack of sequestration would help, because the jurors know what just happened in the same geographical circumference. And so, yes, I do believe it helps the prosecution.
Is it possible, though, to get to impanel a jury they already have, where they, because everybody's seen the tape, the whole world has seen the tape. So when you go to voir dire and you're asking these questions, Attorney Pettit, are you picking out a particular juror that you, I think I can flip that one?
No, every time you question a jury of voir dire, the first question, as the doctor indicated, is can you be biased? Or do you have an opinion, a negative opinion of the police, or a negative opinion of people who bring, prosecute the police? And all of that has to be fleshed out in voir dire. And once you get those type of preliminary answers, then you can either use the strikes that you're given in terms of necessary or absolute strikes for people who have a prejudice for cause, or you can use the peremptory strikes, which you use as a matter of record, because each side is allowed a certain preemptory strikes. So you have a whole bunch of different strikes to weed out those people who make indications to the court that they, for whatever reason, cannot be biased. So that's what the judge is putting his hat on, that he has done that, and he probably will not sequester them, but he probably will voir dire them again, if he hasn't done so already, to ask them whether the right trial down the street, or whether anything else has changed their opinion in terms of them being able to be unbiased.
Yeah, and Dr. Leon, I'm sure you recall the OJ trial, and they went through the same voir dire. And in the end, after the verdict came down, the prosecution said that it was jury nullification, that whatever was going to put on that black panel was not going to convict OJ. Do you see any circumstances, any similarities to this particular trial?
Well, let me not speak to similarities. Let me first point out to one difference: change venue. In the OJ trial, they moved the trial from where Rodney King was beaten in Los Angeles to Simi Valley, the home of darn near every cop on the LAPD. And so they moved to a venue that was where the mindset of protecting the police was alive and well and living in Simi Valley, because so many of those police officers lived in Simi Valley. Here, they did not have change of venue. So it's taking place in the city of Minneapolis. So
the OJ trial.
I'm sorry?
The OJ trial.
No, I'm saying the OJ trial took place in Simi Valley. No, they had a change of venue in the OJ trial. They have not had a change of venue here. And so the change of venue benefited the prosecution, even though they didn't win the case.
All right, Counselor.
Well, that's a major factor, the fact that change of venue was not allowed. But let me just go back to the evidence in this case. We see something here that a lot of us didn't have in terms of prior histories. We did not have the event of technology. Mm-hmm. We did not have the event of cameras. We did not have the event of cell phones. And so this is a first instance, because body cameras and all of these things are relatively novel. And so that is still the major evidence in terms of, you've got a visual, you've got technology showing you what happened. You got technology heard where you can hear the people saying you're choking him to death in terms of intent and so forth. You got the technology that we did not enjoy years ago. I've tried, I guess, I've handled over 50 to 75 police brutality cases. And I used to realize that the police always had the upper hand because people wanted to believe the police. And for me, it was always, I had to come up with witnesses because I didn't have the benefit of technology. I might have, I think, had one of the first cases in the nation that was videoed, and that was a case by the name of Mr. Quarles, who was in front of a religious ceremony when he was shot to death, and everybody saw it on national television, just like Rodney King. But other than that, we just didn't have that at the time of these crimes and these heinous acts. And here, this prosecution has that and has to come back. All will continue to come back is that, believe what you see in the video. This is real time. This is what happened. And the defense will argue, don't believe your lying eyes.
Right. Can I follow up to that, Carl?
Sure.
Attorney Pettit, if you could speak to, I mentioned this earlier, but to the point about the video, speak to that the prosecution still has to prove intent.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
Intent is one of the elements of the charges, and even to get to depraved indifference, they still have to prove intent.
Well, that I'm not too sure about. See, manslaughter, you got to prove intent. And also second-degree murder, you might have to prove intent. I'm not exactly sure that in that murder three count, mm-hmm. I think that's why it went up on appeal and came back to the judge, mm-hmm. because I think the act in itself, in terms of reckless endangerment to the life of others, is what the instructions that should go to the jury, is this is what you have to decide. Whether the act in itself was a violation of the rights of Floyd, and that in itself being the criminal act. I'm not sure that in number three, murder three, that they really have to go to intent like they will for manslaughter and murder two.
All right, folks, you just
could be right. I could be wrong on that, Doc. But
I thought depraved indifference, and don't you have to show? Isn't there some element of you have to show the depravity?
Well, in this instance, if you have to show the depravity, that's where you get into what the bystanders were saying that he could hear and was responding to when they kept telling him he's dead or he's dying, mm-hmm. and take your knee off of his neck. Mm-hmm. That would show the depraved indifference, but I don't think you have to prove intent like you do, obviously, for murder one, okay. murder two, and, in fact, manslaughter. But mm-hmm. I could be wrong on that.
All right. If those of you just joining us, this is a Power Talk series on WOL, the Derek Chauvin trial. As you see, we've got Attorney A. Dwight Pettit and Dr. Wilmer Leon with us tonight. And going back to what you just mentioned about the crowd, and I want to get your thoughts, Dr. Leon, about the crowd. The claims of crowd were sort of intimidated by that crowd. Do you think that went over well with the jury? Do you think they bought there was a young girl and three or four people there, and he felt threatened by that crowd? Do you think that went over well?
I hope it didn't, because it sure didn't impress me. They never stepped off the curb. I can't say that. There was a female firefighter, say that three times fast, who stepped off the curb to tell Chauvin that she was a firefighter and that she wanted to render assistance. She was told by the Asian officer, Tao, get back on the curb. And she did it immediately. The first brother that showed up, that was the mixed martial artist. Yeah. He never stepped onto the curb. In fact, he was very clear in saying, the reason that I did not interfere was because A, I didn't want to get shot, and B, because I'm a professional and I wanted to act as a professional. So if those individuals standing as far away from Chauvin as they were. Tao never had to touch anybody. He was the one that was standing point man, protect between the crowd and Chauvin. He never had to touch anybody. There were a couple instances where he had to tell people get back, you know, blah, blah, blah. But nobody ever touched him. Nobody ever got close enough. There may have been some verbal threats made, but there was no one close enough to actually act upon the threat that was made. And I think Attorney Pettit can clarify for me, if you're not close enough to act on the threat you're making, you're not making a threat. So I think the answer was no.
Counselor?
Well, you know, I think that the crowd was not threatening. The crowd was basically begging for some emotional understanding of the life was it was involved. And but what they're going to use is what I went back before. The case is a Supreme Court case, and it's called Graham versus Connor. And that case, again, as I've said earlier, basically says you cannot speculate, you cannot imagine, you cannot Monday morning quarterback. You got to put yourself in the mind and of the officer, the reasonable, objective officer. And what they're going to try to say, folks, you may not think that you were in danger, but this officer, Chauvin, felt he was in danger because of the crowd, because of, if you want to say it, because he's a big black male. Because he might have had some prior knowledge of Mr. Floyd. What they're going to argue that it's not in your legal power to, in fact, come up with another conclusion of what should have been done or what would have been done under different facts and different circumstances. You have to, according to the law, you've got to put yourself in the mind of the officer and whether his actions were reasonable, objectively reasonable, under the circumstances that he was thinking about, the crowd and everything else. That's a bad law. It's a bad conclusion of law. It's a bad analogy of law, but that's the law.
Yeah, but how do you think the jury felt about that, though? Because, you know, the panel, if they identify with a police officer, they would say, yeah, I agree. He was intimidating. You've got a big black guy. He's trying to restrain. And you've got a crowd of people screaming at you, you know. I'd do the same thing.
But here's going to be the argument of the defense. I'm sorry, Doc. Go ahead.
To you, Attorney Pettit, I would ask the question to the issue of threat. I would ask the question, well, tell me if this is the question to ask. Show me where Chauvin demonstrated he was threatened. Show me through his actions, did he put his hand on his service weapon? Did he draw his service weapon? Did he reach for his baton? Did anybody ever threaten to use mace? Were there any defensive actions taken by Chauvin or any of the other officers to demonstrate that they felt threatened by the crowd? And based on the video I saw, other than Tao saying, step back, step back, step back, the answer was no. He sat there basically with a smile on his face with his knee on the neck.
Well, see, that's what's so important about whether or not Chauvin is going to testify, because he needs to testify to tell the jury what was in his mind, mm-hmm. what his apprehensions were, what he was thinking. And without that, that's part of the major aspect of the defense. And the risk that we said before that he's running is because his record comes out if he takes the stand. But that's a major defense. In terms of not what other people would do, not what you think he should have done, but what was in his mind, which is a very difficult thing to defend about or to prosecute about, what was in his mind, according to the U.S. Supreme Court, at the time he was making the observations of the crowd and every other thing else, that he felt that he was in imminent danger of bodily injury or death.
If what it's about training?
That he is, then that's a defense that's going to be argued by the defense.
What about training? Because
training's going to come up, no question.
No, but specifically, training in terms of how you are taught to deal with crowds in that particular type of situation. And Officer Chauvin, did you or Officer Tao have to employ any of the tactics that you have been taught in terms of crowd control, in terms of tactics that you employ to be sure that I would have to ask, show me what tactics you employed to demonstrate that you were in fear other than keeping your knee on this man's neck and ignoring what the people were telling you.
But see, if he doesn't take the stand, you don't have that opportunity.
No, I understand what you're saying. I understand what you're saying, but I'm saying if he did take the stand, then one of the things, if I were the prosecutor, one of the questions I would ask him is, in terms of your training, how are you trained to deal with hostile crowds, and show us on this film where you had to take action, the type of action you were taught in order to either defuse the crowd or protect yourself against the crowd?
Dr. Leon, I agree with you. I mean, training is going to be permeated throughout this case. That's the conflicting testimony of experts that you're going to hear in terms of the arguments of the defense and the state when you get to closing arguments. The whole thing in terms of what he did, you know, if you notice, they were talking about his foot being in the middle of the back or on the shoulder or on the neck, and the crowd and the apprehension and what he thought or should have been thinking. All of that's going to go back to training. But I'm just giving you all of the different defenses that is available to the defense. And it's terrible that it is, but that's the way American jurisprudence has been created to, in fact, protect the police. Now, the difference is that here, the prosecution is behind the prosecution of the police. And that makes a difference in all the cases I've had where I've been the plaintiffs. And anytime I wanted to make a question or make a remark or on cross-examine a witness, the court would say, Mr. Pettit, I'm going to sustain the objection because you're going trying to use examples other than what was in the state of mind of the officer in question at the time of these events.
Hey, Carl, one of the things I'd like to see is the communication record between the officers on the scene and dispatch. Did they call for backup? Because one of the things that, you know, if you're dealing with a hostile crowd, one of the things you're going to do is get on your mic and say, hey, send the cavalry because we're catching hell. And if that distress call wasn't made, then how threatened did you really feel?
Yeah, good question. I want to go back to the training issue, Attorney Pettit, the Dr. Leon mentioned, because can the defense bring a witness that say the restraining technique was within department policy? Therefore, he did nothing wrong because he was within the guidelines of the police department.
That's what you're going to hear, Carl. That's exactly what you're going to hear. And the counter to that, again, is qualified immunity, because if they went too far, they're going to argue, according to the Supreme Court, that that ignorance is a defense. Because if he goes too far in terms of where his knee was, they're going to say, well, he was trained to put the knee in the back, but he did not know he could put the knee on the neck. I mean, so they're convoluted arguments, but that's how the defense is going to confuse or attempt to confuse the jury.
Well, we heard that today because he said he put his knee on the top of his spine.
Right. That's what they're setting up.
Right. So they're setting this up. Good move?
Oh, yes. For the defense, excellent move. It's the only thing that they can try to go back to is policy and procedure and causation. Those are their main elements. And what I've already said about the officer in terms of deadly force. If he feels that his life is in jeopardy, either by the crowd or by Floyd, then his perception is what controls, not what other people would perceive or think, what was in his mind. And that's the difficult hurdle that the state has to be careful about, the defense making that argument.
You know, some people are saying this is a slam dunk.
And no, yet, no.
You don't, oh, that's what I was going to ask you. Mm-hmm. Dr. Leon?
No, this is as Attorney Pettit said in one of his comments early in the presentation, is that the law is set up and established to protect the police. That's the legal side of the argument. The social side of the argument is this is a white cop that killed a black man in a predominantly white city. And history tells us cops, people do not like to convict police officers. They just don't like to do it.
Yeah.
And so for as obvious as the video is, the defense, and again, the prosecution's got to pitch a perfect game. 12-0. Defense is 1-11. They only need one out of 12. And so this is far from a slam dunk.
Okay. Let me ask this question, though. The film that we see, the video, 9 minutes and change, and we saw it over and over when the defense started, could that backfire on them? Could that turn off members of the panel, counselor, you think?
I don't see how that can turn off the panel whatsoever. That should be, that's the evidence that the prosecution has to go back to over and over and over, that you saw reality. You saw him pleading for his life. You saw him saying, I can't breathe, and what have you. That is the primary piece of evidence. But let me just show you an example of a case that I was involved in with Johnny Cochran when he was alive, of course. It was a case here in Baltimore where the young man was just like this case, was put on his stomach, and the police were handcuffing him. And of course, he was struggling a little bit to try to keep from getting handcuffed, and the policeman shot him in the back of the head. Now you say that would be a slam dunk. And it was a lady there on the porch there that I interviewed. I'll never forget this as long as I live. She said, Mr. Peddle, I was so shocked. I was running to the phone to call the police, and then I realized it was the police. Well, we couldn't even get the prosecution to bring the action against the police when the man was shot in the back. No gun, no nothing, being handcuffed at a traffic stop. And so that shows you how difficult it is normally in terms of prosecution to do any of these type of things, because people, just as Dr. Leon said, people want to believe the police. The police are the good guys. They are protecting me. They're officer friendly. They want to take their testimony as the absolute. And all of this is just beginning to crack because of technology.
There was a case in Pennsylvania about 2 years ago, traffic stop. Young man jumps out the car and runs. Cop shoots him in the back, and it's on video.
I had several of those.
Cop got off. Video,
but I had the shootings. These cases of shootings in the back, unarmed.
This shooting was on video. Wow. Somebody in an apartment across the street heard the sirens and started taping. They got the whole thing. Shot the kid in the back, unarmed. Kid was unarmed. Cop got off.
Dr. Leon, Attorney Petty mentioned that people want to believe the police on the panels. Do you think that's so in the Black community, though? Do you think people want to believe our community, people want to believe the cops?
We want to believe the police. Unfortunately, our history tells us that our faith in the police has been misplaced. And so we have our history is replete. The book, We Charge Genocide, which was the case that was brought before the UN. Attorney out of San Francisco, George. Anyway, I got it back here. So, I'm drawing a blank on his name right now. Was a charge against the United States for genocide against Black people, primarily based upon the way that we had been treated by the police and other law enforcement entities. So we want to trust the police. We'd love to trust the police. Unfortunately, our history is replete with justifiable evidence and proof as to why we can't.
Right.
But the answer
Look what happened yesterday.
Yep.
Sunday in Minnesota. Yeah. She thought she was reaching for the Oscar Grant defense. She thought she was reaching for her taser and put a 9mm round in the young man.
Counselor, back to your question, Dr. Leon is totally correct. People want to believe the police, Black and white. It's not a racial thing. It's almost protection things, that they are our savior, especially in high crime district. I lost a case once where the young man was running. Had jumped off of his motorcycle, and shot him in the back, killed him, And the defense was, I thought he was reaching while he was running for a gun. No gun, no weapon was ever found. And the jury, this is what blew my mind. The jury, I had an all-black jury in Baltimore City. That's still a rare thing to get. And the jury acquitted him, not acquitted him, but voted for the defense in that particular case. And when I questioned the jurors afterwards, they said, Mr. Pettit, we, you know, the police made a good witnesses. They brought their families in. They brought their wives in. And they apologized for what had happened. And we just believe that they didn't intend to do it.
Wow.
This is the book, We Charge Genocide. The crime of government against the Negro people. It was William Patterson, an attorney out of civil rights attorney out of San Francisco, who brought this case before the UN 1954, I think it was.
Okay, we got a question for you. I think it's for Attorney Pettis. Suggestions for others who may find themselves in George Floyd's situation or what happened Sunday. I'll throw that in as well in Minneapolis.
Well, only thing I can say, Carl, is that if you're stopped by the police, and I think most black men in America have been, I was stopped years ago and pulled out of the car or told to get out the car. The mess that George Floyd did, everything you could do, as well as the Wright case, the one that Dr. Leon is talking about, you know, everything you can do to cooperate, show your hands, any type of animosity, sell it, save it for the courtroom. I advise people, and my son and my daughter, if you have that type of situation, try to be as cooperative as you can be, because they've got the badge, as I told about my book, Under Color of Law. They got the gun, they got the stick, and they got the law on their side.
Even if they're trying to provoke you.
In many cases, they are trying to provoke you. The time I was stopped, I was pulled, taken to get out of my car. I had to lean across the hood of my car, all because I was driving a car which they deemed to be a vehicle being driven by a black person. And so all of us have been through that. You just have to control yourself and say, I will fight this battle in the courts. You can't win on the streets.
Dr. Lee, I want to go back to the trial. They've submitted evidence about that George Floyd had all these drugs in his system and he had pre-existing conditions. How do you think that went over with the panel? Do you think they bought that? Do you think that was that was effective for the prosecution?
Well, a couple of things. One is it plays to a stereotype. The defense was playing to a stereotype, and that is, we're drug crazed maniacs and we're animals. So that's one point.
Yeah.
But to specifically answer your question, the best answer I can give you is the prosecution, I think, did a phenomenal job diffusing that argument. They had, I think, three forensic pathologists or they had a cardiologist, they had a forensic pathologist, and I'm not sure what the other expert was. All of them basically said the same thing. What killed Mr. Floyd was deprivation of oxygen to the brain that resulted in a massive coronary. And you had one pathologist who said the amount of fentanyl and or methamphetamine in his system was so negligible. And that's why the defense then had to come back on cross-examination and talk about history of drug abuse. And he even compared it to smoking at one point, to which the pathologist said, well, of course, someone who smokes for 50 years is going to have a bigger problem with smoking than someone who smoked one or two cigarettes over the course of their life. So all I can say, in my opinion, is the prosecution did a phenomenal job in diffusing that argument and keeping the jury focused on these 9 minutes and 20 some odd seconds. Deprivation of oxygen to the brain is what caused this man's heart attack and death.
Attorney Pettit, do you agree? Do you think it may convince one or two that he's ingested these drugs and he's got this super...
Oh, that's the out.
Yeah, yeah. That's the out.
That's what that's what the defense is trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Do you think
if one jury, ball game won, ball game over?
But do you think it was effective? Dr. Leon says he didn't think so. Do you think, as an attorney, when you heard that, do you think that was effective?
Well, you got to realize that the definition that the judge is going to send to the jury is the cause of death had to be substantial. And they're going to try to argue that there were other intervening situations, such as the drugs. And what they're going to argue against is the element of the law that requires substantial cause of death. And I think, you know, the prosecution did everything it could in terms of witnesses to basically say the cause of death is asphyxiation. But the defense is going to try to take that apart in terms of creating doubt, reasonable doubt. That's all you have to do with the jury, that these other actions or other activities caused the death. And, you know, one of the state's witnesses there, or the defense's witnesses, is a witness I had in Baltimore City, medical examiner. And I had two cases with asphyxiation. And in both situations, the defense at that point in time, I was the plaintiff, my client was the plaintiff. The defense at that point in time was trying to argue that my client died because of the heat. One case, they said, West case in Baltimore City, he died because of wrestling with the officer. It was 95 degrees that day, and the exertion of an overweight man caused such an anxiety that he died from a heart attack. Ridiculous. We had to bring in our own witnesses in both cases, here and Baltimore County, the Boyd case and the West case, to testify that the cause of death was asphyxiation. And both of those cases settled because we were going to knock out the medical examiner's testimony that it was something other than the wrath of the officers.
And right. Carl, let me be real clear, real quick. I think the prosecution did as good of a job as they possibly could. But I started my answer with the perception of how we are and I did that because implicit in that was, if there is a juror who's looking for an out, this is one of the outs that they can take.
Right.
Stereotype is the word I used.
Yeah. And we're winding down. So, before I let you guys go, Dr. Leon, anything you want to add that we didn't get a chance to talk about?
No, man. I think you've done a phenomenal job in covering the issues, particularly since today is the first day of the defense presenting their case. We don't know. We have an idea of the line they're going down. But no, I think you did a phenomenal job in the questions that you presented. This is not a slam dunk, you got to pray.
Sadly. Attorney Pettit, anything?
Yeah, I would agree with Dr. Leon that it's been a great show. I just wanted to say that the only way that we're going to resolve these problems is politically. We've got to harness the political power of the Black community to get rid of some of these archaic protection laws that protect the police. And, this is what the courts are using. This is what the legislators are using. We just had a bill passed here in Maryland, which goes to, in fact, deprive the police of a lot of those regulations and things that they've been used to defending themselves. But that's what has to change in this nation is the laws and the interpretation of the laws and the court's interpretation of all of these laws, allowing them to shield the police. I mean, the most ridiculous law, again, going back to qualified immunity. She indicated that the qualified immunity law was a defense of ignorance, that you could do what you did or the police could do what they did because they did not in fact know the law. That's a ridiculous defense, but the Supreme Court has said that you can use that defense. And that was Ruth Bader Ginsburg that wrote the dissent in that particular case. And she actually, I'm paraphrasing her, but actually said, this defense is a defense of ignorance, that you can kill black people or do whatever you want to do and then claim you didn't know that you couldn't.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much. We've run out of time. We'll probably have to do this again, you know, at some time later in the day whenever this trial reaches its conclusion. But thank you for sharing your ideas with us tonight. And thank you, folks, for watching us as well on this Power Talk series, the first for WOL, the Derek Chauvin trial. Good night.
Thank you, Carl.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, Attorney Pettit.